You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome to The Fabulous Invalid, a Broadway-centric podcast where we take a 360-degree look at the theater with actors, directors, writers, and everyone in between. I'm Jamie Dumont, recovering Broadway marketer, executive chef, and event planner.
And I'm Rob Russo, writer and theater critic with Stage Left at NYC.
I feel like I need to take that again. I feel like I didn't quite get my credits.
I
do that a lot where I'm like, I have to like remember who I am. I was a Broadway marketer. Well, what does that mean? I worked for a Broadway marketing company. I was an executive chef and I had a catering company.
Yeah.
That's me.
That's who you are.
All right. Should we do it again?
Let's do a clean one. You know I love a clean one.
We might like this. You know how I love behind the curtain.
You do.
Your least favorite thing.
You live behind the curtain.
Well, what do you always say? Don't hang a lantern on it, Jamie.
Yeah, don't hang a lantern on your problems. You know? Yeah,
I am a lantern.
That's a different podcast.
Guess what today is, Rob? Today is like, I think, one of your favorite days.
Certainly, but it's more so one of your favorite days.
Yes, yes. We talked about this last year. I love a list.
You love a list.
I love a list.
You live for a list.
That I do.
Yeah, yeah. So on this episode, we're taking a departure from our normal routine where we have an interview with a personality who's in the theater. And for this episode, we're going to talk through my list of my top 10 favorite shows of 2019.
Yay!
Sort of an end of the year or almost end of the year countdown.
Are there any rules we should know about?
Rules of the road. I did as I always do, and because I write a piece for my site, and I counted up the number of shows I saw this year. So in 2019, including a couple that I know I'm going to see after we tape this, I will have seen by the end of the year 234 performances, and that includes theater, dance, music, opera, cabaret. A couple repeats, obviously, because, you know, we saw Mean Girls like four times in 2019.
And we're going on Sunday.
Right, you know, because of Jennifer Simard. Still, you know, it's a lot of shows. So what I try to do at the end of the year is to pick my 10 favorite.
Are you up or down from last year? Sorry to interrupt.
I'm down marginally. I saw like 246 or something last year.
Okay.
Yeah. I took it easy this year.
You did. You really, really slacked.
Yeah. I really slummed it.
Lazy.
But my whole mantra, other than you do you, is that I consider this a top 10 favorite, not best. Right. So that's one thing just to put out there. Because that might be a different list, but I don't know that I'm interested in that list, because who am I to say what is the best, right? I mean, when thinking about art and performance in particular, I mean, who's anyone to say what the best is?
But right? I think by virtue of the fact that you are a critic, doesn't that give you some right to say what you think is the best?
Everyone's a critic, Jamie.
But that's what you do weekly.
Right, yeah.
You give us your opinion.
That's real.
So I don't see why... Eventually, we won't do a show.
A best.
Yeah, well, you know, I said this last year, and I'm going to say it again, and I didn't hold you to it, although I did.
No, broken promises.
Violently. Well, we made two broken promises.
A trail of broken promises.
And the one thing I am going to hold you to is the top 50 all-time greatest musicals, which I asked you to do last year.
Like the day we met.
No, that... That I think was the overtures. I think the first list I made you do was the overtures.
And I did that.
You did it right away.
I followed rules.
I was very impressed. Yeah. I was like, this
it was
this
20
kid,
overtures
I like this
and
guy.
I did a good job.
Yeah. No. But we talked about it last year, so we don't have to talk about it again. But the other broken promise,
yeah.
I emphatically said that I was gonna go to LTC.
LCT.
Oh, sure.
LCT 3.
Right.
In fact.
Can't even get the name right. Well,
maybe that was your problem.
You know? Maybe if I had gone, I'd get the name right.
Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah. We'll have to look at the calendar and get you to something.
Before the end of the year?
No, I don't think so. I don't think there's anything playing there right now.
Yeah. I think we
wow,
devastating. Remember that.
Okay, well, we failed each other in 2019. So here's the 2020. Let's not fail each other in 2020. So we're going to tick through my top 10 and we'll go in reverse order because that makes it more fun. One thing to flag is that there were three major productions in 2019 that had off-Broadway iterations in 2018 and were in my top 10 last year. So I decided as my own rule, since I make my own rules, that I was not going to consider them to be eligible for this list. So you might be wondering, well, how come he didn't mention X? It's because it was on last year's list. So the three productions in particular, they are Fiddler on the Roof in Yiddish, Joel Grey's stunning production, which we talked to him about in our first episode. Oklahoma, which was at St. Anne's Warehouse and is now on Broadway and runs through January.
So get tickets if you haven't seen it.
Yes.
Seriously,
oh
don't please. Miss
it
this.
It was my number one last year, and if I could make it my number one this year, I would.
Yeah, but well, I think we both would.
Yeah. What the Constitution Means to Me. Heidi Schreck's incredible play.
Which those are your number ones on each list, right? Like if you were to break it out between
plays and musical. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So those were three amazing productions that were off Broadway in 2018, on Broadway or in New York, moved to Midtown in 2019. Didn't consider them for this list. So here we go. Let's just do it.
Let's do it.
Let's dive right in. And right away, right off the bat, I'm making an exception. Again, because I make the rules. It's my list.
You make the rules.
10 is a tie. So I guess it's technically 11, but I did that in 2017. Sunny in the Park with George and Sweeney Todd were a tie, a little Sondheim tie. So this year, instead of being a Sondheim tie, it's a Bess Wahl tie.
Which is a good tie.
It's a good tie to have, yeah, as far as ties go. Playwright Bess Wahl had two incredible plays off-Broadway, Make Believe at Second Stage and Continuity at Manhattan Theater Club. Very different plays in content, obviously. But both, I think, and we saw them together. Yes, we did. We saw both these together.
We saw both of them.
And I think you would agree with me that Bess Wahl, as a playwright, has an incredible ability to sort of lure you into the play. And you think you're watching one thing, and then suddenly, or over the course of the play, reveals itself to be something entirely different. And we were both, in different ways, stunned by those two plays. Make Believe, in particular.
Make Believe, I physically couldn't move for the last 20 minutes of that play. Once the thing is revealed,
right.
I was frozen. I was so ill-prepared. And I should have known, right? There were clues there.
Yeah.
But I will say she's also very good at not giving too many clues.
Well, right.
And it's like a sucker punch
in
the best possible way.
Absolutely.
I don't mean that to sound negative.
Yeah.
Make Believe in particular, I can't remember the last time I was so just wrecked by something and just immobile.
Yeah. And it was also just a fabulous production.
Yeah, really
the,
was.
The design of it, the actors. I mean, it was masterfully done.
Yeah.
And then Continuity... becomes this like poignant parable about the climate crisis, set on a movie set in the desert.
Right. You think you're watching this movie about these vapid Hollywood people.
Yeah, and it's sort of like this farce, it's like a romp.
So funny.
Yeah.
Which Make Believe wasn't as funny.
No.
So they're so different.
Right.
She's such a great writer.
Yeah.
It's almost as if these two plays were written by totally different people.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you can see the parallels in both of them.
Right. That skill, that ability to sort of turn on a dime and keep the audience on their toes. So unfortunately, because they're both, at off-Broadway nonprofit theater companies, they've since closed. But this has suddenly become a Bess Wahl fan club episode of the Fabulous Invalid,
which
I think we're both okay with. Her next play, Grand Horizons, is going to be opening at Second Stage on Broadway at the Helen Hayes Theater in January. So we will have an opportunity to see a new Best Wall play in the new year.
We need to do that together.
Absolutely.
I think it's the thing we have.
Grand Horizons is also directed by Lee Silverman, guest of the show, who we love.
Oh, love
and
her
has
a lot.
An amazing cast. Jane Alexander, James Cromwell, Priscilla Lopez.
Ashley Park, another guest of the show.
Yeah, I mean.
We should get Michael Urie on the show.
We really should in the new year.
Yeah.
Anyway, so.
Michael, if you're listening, we're gonna start stalking you.
So top 10 list, number 10, technically 10 and 11. Shh, don't tell anybody. Make believe, continuity. Love it. Moving to number 9 is The Inheritance.
I love The Inheritance.
Yeah. So I have to say, you know, it's interesting. I went back and listened to our fall preview episode. And on that episode, I boldly predicted, I said at the time, I'm making a bold prediction, that The Inheritance would be like the event of the season. And I have egg in my face because I think the play has not been as warmly received as I was anticipating it would. Certainly not as it was in London in 2018. It won all the awards, was the talk of the town, sold out. It's been a bit of a chilly response on Broadway.
I think that's not entirely accurate. I think it's like aggressive.
Yeah, a little hostile.
It feels hostile.
A little hostile, yeah.
I feel like it is an event, but it's the wrong kind of event.
Yeah, exactly. It's turned out to be the opposite kind of event.
There's a lot of hatred towards this play or just outright dismissal of it.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of different reasons for that, but I find it so fascinating how vilified this play is being on social media in particular. I think if you look at the reviews of the play, they were mixed.
Yeah,
right.
I think that's fair.
And a lot of people said a lot of really nice things about the play.
Yeah.
But the social media world seems to really just want to shit all over it.
Yeah. Well, it's important to remember that Twitter is not real life.
No,
you
it's
know?
True.
But yeah, I mean, at the time you said that you thought Slave Play would be more polarizing than The Inheritance, you know,
who knew?
Which it's turned out to be the opposite.
Right. And Slave Play's turned out to be the feel good hit of the season.
Right. Yeah. Bring the family to Slave Play. You know, I mean, that's like who we are. Anyway. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously I think the play has its own faults and, you know, we could go into that, but this is a show to sort of spotlight what we love about the season. And I love this play. I love the experience of watching it. I love the device, the construct of it. You know, if you don't know, it's sort of a contemporary adaptation of E.M. Forster's novel, Howard's End, but set among a group of millennial-aged gay men in New York in the present, sort of grappling with the legacy of the AIDS crisis of the 1980s and 1990s to the present, truly. And you know, it's an epic play. It's six acts. It's two parts. It's 6 hours and 45 minutes running time. It's a big piece. And I think when something is of that scale, it gets a lot of eyes on it to sort of live up to people's expectations of what a 6-hour play should be. And, you know, the big marker for that is Angels in America. And, you know, Angels in America is a different play by a different playwright trying to do something very different than what The Inheritance, you know, is doing. You know, and thematically, they're even very different.
But also, The Inheritance, everything is stripped away. I mean, literally, the actors are barefoot.
Right.
And there's almost, with the exception of a few things here and there.
There's like a chair and some wine glasses.
There's very little set pieces.
That's
there's
it.
Very little set, right?
No,
there's
no.
one, there's sort of one device that comes in and out that's quite effective. But it's really, everything is just stripped away and you're sort of forced to just be with these people.
Totally.
Which I loved.
Right. And I think you're tapping into something that's exactly right. And that is, you know, people have focused on Matthew Lopez, the playwright, on, you know, on what he has created. But I think what's gotten lost in some of the discourse around this show is the fact that Stephen Daldry, the director, and Bob Crowley, the designer, have collaborated to make a very unique and special sort of theatrical evening or day, I guess, because it is two parts. The way this play is performed itself is an achievement that I think is worthy of real celebration. And just kind of shocked that has sort of fallen by the wayside. Anyway, I really enjoyed the play when I saw it in London. I enjoyed seeing it on Broadway. It's changed a little bit. And certainly the context has changed. You know, you can't help but see this play through the prism of our culture, our, you know, the news, and through a racial lens. And that, I think, is what a lot of the criticism has been about the show in America, because that lens is not as sharp over across the pond. Anyway, certainly one of my favorites of the year at number nine. Number eight on my list is Akhenaten, which is a Philip Glass opera that was at the Metropolitan Opera this fall, a new production of an old opera. So it was written in 1983. It's part of a trilogy that Philip Glass did, sort of doing portraits of great leaders, the others being Mahatma Gandhi and Albert Einstein. So this is about the Egyptian pharaoh Akhenaten, who you know, had a historic reign, and I think he basically united Egypt. But what was amazing about this production, I don't know if this is the way it's always been done, but you know, Jamie, you saw it with me, so you can attest. It played out like a religious ritual almost. And the entire piece, you know, because it's Philip Glass, so the music is very repetitive. And I mean that, you know, not as a negative thing, it's just a fact of how he composes. And you almost were like induced into like a trance-like, you know, meditative state while watching this opera unfold. And it moved in with such precision and with such a reduced speed that, you know, we're inundated by fast things, right? You know, in our society now, everything's fast, everything's now, everything's big, everything's flashy, everything's fast. To sit in the Metropolitan Opera and see something slow down time was a really fascinating experience, unlike anything I've ever experienced before. It's always a joy to see anything at the Met Opera, but especially a new production of a modern opera. They can do things there on a scale that you really don't experience kind of anywhere else. So that was a real treat. And again, unlike anything I've ever seen before in my life.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I would not have done that if you had not,
you know, and it closed, invited me. It closed December 7th. And that's it for the year. It was just for the fall season, you know, cause they perform in rep, and it was sold out.
I have a feeling they'll do it again because I feel like it was a really popular opera. I feel like that and Porgy and Bess are their two season highlights so far.
Yeah, totally. So moving down the list, number seven, or I guess I should say up the list. Down, up, sideways?
Well, which way does the Nile go?
Up.
It goes the opposite direction.
Yeah. Anyway, to number seven is American Utopia.
Which I did not see, so I cannot comment.
Okay. Oh, wow, Jamie. Just recusing yourself from the conversation.
I think that's fair.
From the get-go. Wow. Well, but I'm sure you have an opinion about David Byrne.
I love David Byrne.
Yes, we all love David Byrne. Music legend David Byrne. I mean, I don't know how else to, categorize him. He's sort of like
because he's not a rock and roller.
No,
he's everything.
He's everything. He's a musician. He's a singer. He's a producer. He's a writer. I mean, he's everything. He has brought his latest album to life, the eponymous, you know, American Utopia, on stage and alongside, you know, his catalog of well-known songs dating back to the Talking Heads. In collaboration with visionary choreographer Annie B. Parson. And it, again, you know, sort of like what we just talked about with Akhenaten, it's unlike anything I've ever seen. And it sort of defies easy categorization, much like David Byrne. So I guess it's not surprising. But, you know, it's a concert, but it's not. It's a kind of a musical, but not really. I mean, there's a thread of a... not so much a story, but an idea, a theme that is, you know, weaved throughout the entire thing. And yet it's just this like joyful, exuberant bringing to life of music. Number six is Moscow, 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 Moscow. Did I say that right? Six Moscows.
I think you missed a Moscow, but who's counting?
Oh, no. playwright Haley Pfeiffer's irreverent new adaptation of Anton Chekhov's Three Sisters, which was at MCC Theater over the summer. I saw it, you know, to review it. And then, like, the second it ended, was like, okay, I need to see this again right away. And fortunately, you were going, and I saw it again with you.
I was going like the week after.
A week later, I went back and saw it, and I would have seen it again if my schedule had permitted me to.
I really thought that was going to transfer. I really felt like that had another life in it. Maybe it does.
I just loved it. So she, you know, she took Three Sisters and basically like obliterated all subtext. And you know, unearthed this humor throughout it by using sort of a contemporary, like millennial parlance for the characters, right? So it's incredibly anachronistic throughout. It's sort of like internet speak, you know, is spoken throughout the entire play. And it's absolutely hilarious. And yet it's not some like takedown of, you know, Three Sisters. It's not this like harsh, you know, modernist take. It in the end is so poignant.
It's surprisingly respectful.
Yes. I was laughing until I was crying. Yeah. Right. And then you're like, oh my God, how did this happen? You know, it was one of those plays where that suddenly you're struck by the fact that you're so moved and yet you've been so entertained to that point, you know? I absolutely loved it. MCC Theater, you know, we love MCC Theater. We're big fans here.
Huge. I say this all the time. It's one of the few theater companies I just go in, I can go in cold and I know I'm going to love it.
And one of the great stories of 2019 is the fact that they're in their new space, the Robert Wilson Theater space on 52nd Street, which, you know, I always say it's the furthest west I ever go in Midtown. It's on 15th Avenue. I mean, I don't even know.
You can't really go much further without being in Weehawken.
Being in the water, yeah. But once you're there, it's worth the trek because the facility is gorgeous.
They've built a marvelous complex. They have a great black box, and then they have a really beautiful and almost odd proscenium theater. Like, it's a really interesting space.
Well, there is
space.
No proscenium, but it
feels like, I guess they're technically, they're both black boxes, really. Yeah. But they have a larger theater that has a mezzanine in it, and it's just, it's very wide. It's very wide, and it's
but you're so close to the stage. I mean, it's really,
it's a marvelous theater. Yeah. However you describe it, go see something there, because it's, you'll
really
love
terrific,
it.
Really terrific, really terrific. Great. Okay, moving on. Number five on my list is Soft Power.
Yay.
Which, if you listen to the show, you know we did an entire episode on Soft Power.
We've been talking about Soft Power pretty much from day one on this show.
Yeah. So if you don't know, somehow, if you don't know about the show, it's at the Public Theater this past fall. David Henry Hwang and Janine Tesori collaborated on writing this new musical within a play. I think the phrase that they ended up using to describe, because it's an interesting structure, a very unique structure, something that I think has never been done before, at least not on this scale, where the show starts out as a play, and then the play that you've seen up to a certain point becomes the sort of substance for a musical dream that carries on for the rest of the show. And you know, the impulse for the show was for it to be a reverse King and I, where this time someone from the East would teach someone from the West a lesson. In the course of developing it, because the show itself deals with so many contemporary themes and, you know, basically the news, the horror we're living in post the 2016 election, it evolved a lot. You know, we saw it in 2018 on the West Coast, and now it premiered finally in New York. And I just think it is such a unique and smart show. And it's exciting to see at this level, these artists taking such a risk in developing something that's never been seen before.
I agree with that. I think it's Janine Tesori's best work. I know you like Caroline Our Change.
Like is a weak word,
correct,
Jamie.
I'm sorry, I'll use the word love.
Thank you.
I love Caroline Our Change, but there's something about this score. I think it's because it's so pastiche and I love pastiche. Mm-hmm. That's why I love Folly so much.
I think
because it touches on so many different sort of musical theater tropes. Is that the right way to put
it? Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know,
themes.
Yeah.
There's definitely moments where you go, oh, that sounds like, and this sounds like, but they're not. They are completely their own thing, and they are unique and original and marvelous. And I love that score, and I'm very, very excited that it's getting a cast album.
Yes. Oh my gosh, I can't wait to listen.
It can't come out soon
enough. It's going to inject it into my veins.
When do we vote? When do we vote? On the Tuesday after the first Monday in the month of November.
The month of November. On the Tuesday after the first Monday in the month of November.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, I'm a little biased because I worked on the 2016 campaign and my boss, Hillary Clinton, is a character in the show, right? So for me, it resonated in a very powerful way. But I think for anyone who, you know, cares about our democracy, this show had a lot to say, and not in a sort of pat or cute way, in a really smart way.
Yeah, it's complicated.
It's complicated.
It's a complicated show. Complicated. Yeah. But it's also like, I think you could also sit back and not pay attention and just look at the visuals and still have a wonderful experience. Don't do that because that's not how you should do it. But there's just so much happening. There's so many layers and levels to this piece.
Yes.
And it all comes together so beautifully.
Yes. Well, I think, you know, it's what I love about it and why it is on my favorite list. And, you know, and I don't think it's on many people's lists at the end of this year because I don't think it engendered the kind of love that I was hoping it would. For me, it did. And part of the reason is that, you know, Jesse Green wrote in his review in the New York Times that it's the kind of show that you need to see more than once. And, you know, he might have been saying that as a bit of a knock on the show. I mean, I don't think so, but I think it could be perceived as a knock on the show. But whereas I see that as like the highest compliment you could ever give a work of theater, because what it means is that there's a lot there, right? That it's not just surface level, that there's so much to explore. I've seen it 3 times. And every time I saw it, both on the West Coast and twice at the Public, I saw something, I learned something, I appreciated something new about it. And that's not the case for every show. I mean, there's some shows, by the end of the first time, you're like, okay, I get it. Right. You know, like by the end of act one, you're like, all right, I see what this is. I've seen all I need to see. Not the case with this. And that's why, you know, among the many reasons why it's a favorite.
Well, we did a full episode about it, you just referenced.
Episode 50.
And have a listen.
Yes.
You're not going to find too many people smarter than David Henry Hwang or Lee Silverman, for that matter, or two more engaging actors than Francis Hsu and
Elise Allen Lewis.
Yeah. So have a listen.
Fabulous. Alrighty.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Moving on to number 4 is Slave Play, we already sort of alluded to earlier in this episode. And this was an honorable mention on my list last year because I had caught it right at the end of 2018 when it was off Broadway at the New York Theater Workshop. And almost a full year, well, less than a full year, like 10 months later, it transferred to Broadway thanks to the intrepid vision of its producers, where, I mean, I cannot recall in the last decade or kind of like ever in my adult life, a playwright who's made more of a splash in New York, who has gone from zero name recognition to being on everyone's lips in the course of a single season, not even a single year, but a single season, than Jeremy O'Harris, the playwright of Slave Play. In part because he's written, you know, a brilliant play, but also because he himself is just such an interesting character, yeah. You know, and I don't mean that as a knock, like, you know, as a character. I mean, he's a smart guy and is so engaging and interesting. And, you know, he's certainly made the most of this moment with this play.
He really has. He's great on social media. Oh, he's great in an interview.
Yeah.
He's a snazzy dresser.
Yes.
He's like the full package.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm like, you know, if they still put playwrights on the cover of Time magazine, he'd be on the cover of Time magazine.
Yeah.
Right.
They should.
Is Time magazine even in print anymore?
I don't think so.
Who knows?
I think it's gone.
But Slave Play. It's hard to talk about Slave Play without giving away Slave Play.
Right.
Right. You know, but I you know, thematically, I guess I can say, you know, it's just this like absolutely brilliant, trenchant satire of white fragility, identity politics, racism, psychotherapy. I mean, you name it, right? Everything under the sun. You know, the play talks about race and gender and sex and history in a way that is so smart and so piercing. I hate using the word provocative. I know a lot of people have called this play provocative. And I think what's provocative is that people would call it provocative, right? Because the fact that we, you know, in America have this like dirty habit of not talking about our own history and our own sins and things like slavery, right, is what has unfortunately gotten us to this moment in our history. And this play is a way, you know, I open my review by saying I often wonder what it would be like for Americans to actually grapple with our racial history, right? And this play sort of gives you an idea of what it would mean like for people to sit in a room together and actually address our racial history. Because we don't,
no,
as a society. I mean, it's crazy. And the fact of us doing it, for that to be called provocative, is like, to me, just ridiculous. You know, it's like, it should be what we do every day. It should be the lens through which we view everything.
Yeah.
And yet it's not.
Yeah. It's shattering is what this play is. It really is.
I like that.
It's a shattering play.
Yes, I like that. Shattering. It's a perfect word. So, and this is another one that runs through January. So,
yeah, the 19th.
Yes.
So get tickets.
Please.
Get tickets.
And you know, even if it's not your cup of tea or it doesn't sound like it's your cup of tea, it's the kind of play that just feels like an important moment in theater history, almost, right?
It's also one of those plays. This was, I think I mentioned this last year. It was in particular at New York Theater Workshop when the I've seen it on Broadway now, what, twice, and it's happened each time.
Yeah.
When the play ends, the audience doesn't know what to do.
Right.
They don't know if they should clap. They don't. It's also the ending is quite shattering.
Yes.
And it's interesting because you don't quite know what you're supposed to do or how you're supposed to feel or what you're supposed to think. Mm. And I don't think even leaving the theater, you can formulate all of that. It really stays with you for quite a while.
It's the kind of play that forces a conversation.
Absolutely.
You know, you walk out of the theater and you have to vocalize something. You don't even know what. You can't formulate the thoughts, but you know you have to say something, right? And, you know, that's what's a better compliment than that, right? I mean, that's why we do theater. That's why we love theater.
Isn't that... and not every show should do that, but most of them should.
Well, here's one that certainly does. Number three on my list... is Follies.
Oh, it's gonna be a lovely party. I'm so glad I came.
Now you might be saying, I didn't see Follies in New York this year. That's right, because I didn't. I saw it in London, and this is a bit of a cheat because this is a production.
Technically.
Yeah, this was a production from 2017 that was done at the National Theater by director Dominic Cook, but it came back in revival at the National Theater again in London this.
Because it was one of their most successful shows of all time, right?
Yes, it sold out in like a minute, and I think this revival sold out in a minute. And I think if they did it again, it would. I like every night I say a prayer that it'll come to Broadway because this production to me of Follies, the Stephen Sondheim musical from 1971, is I think as close, you know, in scale and vision, to the iconic original, you know, Hal Prince, Michael Bennett production as we're likely to ever see, you know, at the Olivier Theater. is huge. If you've never been, it's this huge auditorium that does not have a proscenium. It's most similar to the Vivian Beaumont.
Correct.
If you've been to that theater at Lincoln Center, has the thrust stage, you know, sort of almost like a 270 degree seating plan. And it's just vast and immense. And so is this show, right? So having it sit in a theater like that, where there's no line between the audience and the stage, and you can play it on the scale that it deserves to be played on, with a cast of 40 and an orchestra of 20, and, you know, really produce the imagery that the show operates in, right? I mean, it's one of the few musicals. I can't think of another one right now. Well, I guess Cabaret is another musical, and another Hal Prince musical. I mean, that makes sense. Where the imagery is almost as essential as the text. And when you can get both right, there's nothing better.
I agree with that. This production never stopped moving.
No.
You know, there was a circular element to it, mm-hmm. right? There was sort of a turntable thing. And
yes.
So the no matter what was happening on stage, there were five or six other things happening.
Mm.
It was, except for a few moments where the action had to stop.
Right, of course.
Right, to focus on a song or whatnot. But pretty much it was fluid throughout. And it was so beautiful. And again, I agree with you. I don't think you'll get closer to the original production than this production.
No, and I mean it in terms of scale and vision, because it's a different production, right? They're not trying to recreate the Hal Prince, Michael Bennett production, right? But it has that essence to it, that sense of occasion, that sense of scale, that sense of storytelling, that make it one of, you know, the greatest musicals ever written, right? And it's like a show that is considered both brilliant and is always a flop, right? You know, like, which is why it was so exciting to see it be such a sensation, because it's never really been commercially successful, I guess I should say.
No, not ever.
You know, who wants to see commercially successful theater? Boring.
I don't.
Boring. And I will just say before we move on, this production contained one of my favorite moments ever in a lifetime of theater going. And that, again, this is like why it, you know, is on this list, right?
I think this is new information for
me. No, as soon as I say it, you're going to know exactly what I mean. If you know the show, there's a song, Who's That Woman? It's the mirror song. Mirror, you know, mirror, mirror on the wall. Where the older Follies girls at this reunion start to recreate this dance number that they used to do. And at a certain point in the number, they're replaced by their younger selves. And there's a flourish in the music. I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it. And the way it was staged in this production, it was musical theater ecstasy of the highest scale. It was like, it was so cinematic. It was so just totally transporting. It was like watching a dream. It was like being in a dream. And that's what I mean when I say about the imagery of the show is so essential to getting it right. And boy, did they nail it.
It was also filmed for National Theater Live.
Yes, and so Live. Love
it. I have yet to see it have a repeat performance. It's not on their website currently, but that always makes me think, maybe they're holding off so they can do another production of it. God, but it was filmed, and so it does live on. And
yeah, that's a good tip if you can find it.
Yeah, I would assume they'll release it at some point.
Some point.
On their website, they have a lot of old stuff. It just hasn't come up yet.
Yeah. That's
but
a great program.
I think
that.
It will.
Yeah.
Maybe they're planning on another revival. You never know.
Please, I would buy a plane ticket in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
See that.
So would
that's
I.
How good it was.
Lord, Lord, that woman is me.
I have one favorite thing I do have to say about this.
Yes,
Follies.
Very fun.
Whether we use this or not. One of the times I saw it, I sat on the extreme side. And there's a moment where Tracy Bennett is down.
Former guest of the show.
She's doing some business. It's again, part of this thing where it's just always moving and things are happening. She's doing some business right in front of where I'm sitting, and she lights up a cigarette. Mm. And I smell it, and I go, mother fucker, that's a real cigarette. That smells like a real cigarette. So I asked her, I just went back and saw her afterwards. And I said, Trace, are you really smoking? She said, of course, darling. And I thought, only in London right. could you smoke a real cigarette on the stage. You right. could never do that in New York. It's all these herbal cigarettes and... Yeah. And oh, or yeah. now they have the fake electronics that oh, you know really? That have yeah. you seen these electronic cigarettes?
I think so, yeah.
So the
or if I did it was so good I didn't notice.
They well yeah. they light up and they puff smoke and they the oh, okay. thing is they don't get any smaller, right? So if somebody's oh. smoking a cigarette for several minutes, yeah. it stays the same length. And I've seen productions where someone tries to put the cigarette out and it's like, well, it's not crushing.
Yeah.
So it needs to be perfected. But God love Tracy Bennett for actually smoking a real yeah. cigarette on stage. Yeah. Only in Britain could yeah. you get away with that.
Love that.
It's an old song.
It's an old song.
It's an old tale from way back when. It's an old song.
It's an old song.
And we're gonna sing it again.
Number two, we're almost done.
Number two.
Okay, number two is Hadestown.
Ugh.
I know.
I can't believe it's number two, but then I know it's number one.
Exactly. So,
so
yeah, you've got a little advance notice. Okay, so Hadestown. It won all the awards.
It won all the awards.
For good reason. I mean, it's just one of the most exquisitely crafted musicals I've ever seen. You know, it's funny. I was just talking about how I can't think of another musical where the imagery is as essential to the success of the show as it is with Follies. Hadestown, duh. I mean, Rachel Chavkin, director, has taken Anais Mitchell's, you know, incredible score and words and put them on stage in, again, just like the most exquisitely crafted way that I could imagine, right? I called it the most tautly constructed and beautifully realized musical on this side of Hamilton. And I stand by that. It's bold
I
claim.
Think you should. It's bold, but
I'm here for bold claims.
I think it's accurate.
Yeah, I mean, it is just this like riveting, heart-wrenching, sumptuous folk opera, right? That vibrantly renders some of the oldest and most well-known and enduring myths of like humankind. And yet it's this like epic modern musical theater piece.
We're gonna sing it again.
We had Andre DeShields on the show back in
December.
No, it was like April.
Was it April?
April or May? It was right before the Tony Awards.
Time is a construct.
Time is a flat circle. You know, he is one of the most incredible performers like ever in the history of Broadway. Right? This cast,
every single person on that stage, yes. is giving a performance of their career.
You know, it feels like the kind of show where for like decades to come, people are going to brag, oh, I saw the original cast of Hadestown.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I saw the original cast of A Chorus Line. Right? Or, you know, like Spring Awakening, right? Look at that cast. Every single person in that cast has gone on to do something incredible, right? And the people in this cast have already gone on, have already done incredible things. I can't wait to see what they will all do in the future.
I cannot imagine the show without Amber Gray.
Yes.
I cannot imagine the show without Patrick Page. Mm. I cannot imagine the show without Andre DeShields.
Right.
I don't even say that.
She can't leave the show. She's
ever.
Not allowed.
Yeah. And that goes for
Reeve Carney.
Reeve and Eva Noblezada and even the Fates.
The Fates.
Like every the ensemble. Single, the ensemble. It's just
Timothy
perfection.
Hughes.
Well, you love Timothy Hughes.
Yes.
Well, like
America loves Timothy
yes.
Hughes.
Well,
he's like the other story of 2019.
12 feet tall and about. Gorgeous. Yeah. Oh, well, that's a good story. Tell the story.
What's the story?
Oh, was that 2018 where he ripped up the Trump flag?
Oh yeah, he did. Yeah, he was in the original cast of Frozen. Yeah.
Was that this year or was it?
No, that was in 2018, I think. Yeah. Someone at the curtain call was like doing a little protest in the orchestra and took out a Make America Great Again banner and he
grabbed
it from the stage.
So he's a national hero.
National hero. Yeah. There should be a bank holiday for his birthday.
I agree with that. Yeah. Should it be today?
Well, we need to find out when that is. Anyway, Hadestown, just incredible. Loved it. Number two of the year. Drumroll, please.
Dun, da, da, da. That wasn't a drum roll, was it?
It was like a little horn flourish.
It was like a,
a little trumpeting.
A fanfare.
fanfare of sorts. Number one, A Strange Loop.
I thought you were going to let me say it. I got excited for a second.
Should we do a take two?
No. This is, honey, this is your show.
Yeah, it's our show.
No, this one's really you. So,
if you listened to our interview with Michael R. Jackson.
Which was last week.
So if you're up on your Fabulous Invalid, you'll know that Jamie and I are huge fans of A Strange Loop, the musical. Michael R. Jackson is a composer, lyricist, and playwright. He wrote the entire thing himself. And it's this extraordinary musical that was at Playwrights Horizons last summer off Broadway. It's a self-referential musical by and about a black queer man writing a musical about a black queer man who's writing a musical about a black queer man who's writing a musical about a black queer. I could go on all day, right?
We get it.
And, you know, talk about shattering, right? This is a musical that shatters expectations and challenges societal limitations around what a black queer man's story can be and should be about. And, you know, it's sort of like soft power. You know, it's the product of someone who clearly loves musicals, admires the form, and is at the same time challenging that form to do something that it's never done before. I mean, we talked about in our interview with Michael R. Jackson that there are very clear, you know, references. There are shows that have existed before that sort of have used some of the same conventions, and yet there's never been a show like A Strange Loop that has put them all together the way that
and as beautifully as he has. I just have to stop you right here because I think it's an understatement of global proportions to say that we like the show.
Did I say like?
Did you say like?
Oh, no.
Did you say like or love? I think adore. You said we're fans of the
we're
show.
We're fans of. Yeah,
I think that
fan is too weak a word.
I think it's too weak a word. I think they're all, I don't know what the right words are.
It hasn't been invented yet.
Because I know we're in agreement.
Violent agreement. That's
violent agreement.
Yes.
When I say this, that this show really touched us and spoke to us on so many different levels. It really got inside of us. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget. We were together when the cast album came out and we listened to it. I think twice fully through. Mm-hmm. We were driving somewhere. But the look on the look of just sheer joy on your face as we were listening to it. I think I even did a video of it because it was just so wonderful.
So pure. Yeah.
But I didn't say pure. But what I mean by saying this is that there are moments when you experience a theatrical piece that change your life and that will stick with you forever. And this is one of those pieces that just is, I think, life-altering and beautiful and perfect and also complicated and simple all at the same time.
Yeah.
And that's hard to do.
Yeah.
And it came out of nowhere and it's been being developed forever.
Forever.
Yeah. Which we talk about on our show, so you can listen to last week's episode and hear the full story.
Yeah. No, but I mean, you've just touched on two things that I think are really important to the A Strange Loop story. Number one is that the show itself just demonstrates the power of what theater and what musical theater in particular, you know, can be and do, right? Michael R. Jackson has, and you know, thank God, an impatience with how unadventurous people are with this art form, right? And has taken that impatience and channeled it into creating something that is so new and so fresh. Even those words feel just so trite in describing the show.
They do.
They're so weak. It's just like there aren't words, right? You have to see it to believe it. And the second point that you just touched on is this cast album. It's perfection. It 100% captures what the show is. And that's hard to do. And not every cast recording does, especially for, you know, a quote-unquote small off-Broadway show, right? The fact that it even has a cast recording is a testament to the producers, you know, Page 73 and Playwrights Horizons, who budgeted that money because it's not cheap, and had the foresight to know that if they wanted the show to make the mark that it can and should, it needed to have a cast recording. And so while unfortunately it closed in, you know, July, you can listen to that cast recording now.
And really feel like you've experienced the show.
Yes, and get a really good sense of the show. Because it captures the performances that were just ravishing.
I want to break the cycle that's so ingrained in me, but change comes way too slow and I am in a hurry. There's all of this rejection which brings such misery, but with my white girl music I drown out the flurry of today. I am a Disney usher, I'm barely scraping by. My discontentment comes in many shapes and sizes. When I wake up each morning, I tell myself to try. I tell myself that I will make no compromises. So days like this just get me. I hate days like today. Days when I face myself but see the same reflection. Someone who's stuck rewriting and stuck in his own way. Someone who has to edit every imperfection today. Today I plan to change myself.
Oh, girl, whatever. I can't help hope that this cast album is the thing that leads to the next production.
Yeah.
That just the existence of this is the thing that either brings it to Broadway or brings it back off Broadway
or
whatever its journey is.
Right. Well, what's so amazing about the show is that you can easily imagine any sort of gatekeeper saying it's too black or it's too queer or it's too this, it's too that, it's too weird, it's too small, whatever. Pick your two.
Which are all things he discusses in the show.
Right. But which are also what make it what it is and why it is so good. Right. Like if he had put up any sort of shield and edited himself to create what he thought people wanted to see, it wouldn't be what it is, and it wouldn't have made the impact that it did. So number one of the year, absolutely adore this show, and I'm so grateful to everyone involved in the show for making it happen, and will live the rest of my life just in love with the experience of seeing it and that cast recording.
Well, that's quite a list.
Quite a list.
What a year for theater.
And as always, I do some honorable mentions on my list because, again, I make the rules, so 10 is too constricting, even when I fudge the rules to do a tie and make it 11. What's interesting about this year as compared to last year is, you know, last year I only had two Broadway shows on my list, and I had, like, everything at the Park Avenue Armory. This year I actually had a fair amount of Broadway shows and a fair amount of musicals as which is exciting.
It's a whole new you.
It's a whole new me. But
a lot of singing today.
A lot of singing.
You're just a songbird.
This is becoming a musical podcast. Becoming? has always been, secretly been. So there's a lot of Broadway shows in my honorable mentions too.
I'll run through them,
Rob. I don't know what it says about Broadway this season. Ain't Too Proud.
Says it's been a good season.
Yeah. Ain't Too Proud, which was just
fabulous.
Go see it.
Go still see running. It.
If you can get a ticket, I mean, it's like sold out. It's a runaway success.
It's huge.
Spoke to Des McAnuff and Tom Hulse, the producer of the show.
We did speak to both of them.
We did some Ain't Too Proud love this season.
Well, deserving
of
the
love.
Yes,
well deserving. All My Sons, the Arthur Miller play was at Roundabout. Absolutely terrific. Beetlejuice, which is like the success story of the year.
But it's a success story of the decade because it was struggling at the box office and not doing great. And suddenly they're wrapping over $1 million a week.
Yes. I mean, it is the major exception to the rule, right? Of a show that has done better successively each week of its run.
Yeah.
That's not how Broadway works.
Ever.
If you're a hit, you're usually a hit right away. And then you peter out over time, whether it's 5 years, a month, whatever, right? This show was not a hit critically, right? I mean, it was kind of dismissed. I said this, you know, at the time. It was kind of dismissed by critics at the time that it opened. And, you know, you can debate whether or not it's a great show. That's fair, you know. But you can't deny the fact that it has caught on and become, you know, a phenomenon of its own, which is pretty exciting to see happen. Bella Bella.
Oh, Harvey Fierstein.
Harvey Fierstein's one-man show about Bella Abzug that was at Manhattan Theater Club.
A love letter to incredible
unsung
woman
hero. Yeah.
that nobody knows the story to anymore.
Right.
Nobody really knows who Bella Abzug.
And if you don't, Google.
Find out how she's changed the world you currently live
in
and doesn't get the credit for it.
Oh my gosh. And I have to say, to see Harvey Fierstein on stage anytime is a treat. But to see him in a one-person show, right, which is sort of how he made his name 30, 40 years ago, right, as a solo performer, oh, my God, he still has it.
Yeah, I agree with that.
He never lost it, but he still has it. A Christmas Carol, which is the old Vic's production that I saw in London last year, absolutely loved, and it's now on Broadway. Absolutely terrific. Cornucopia, which was Bjork's theatrical concert at The Shed, which is that new performance venue that we had talked to David Rockwell about when we had him on the show last season. Again, it was like, unlike, you know, sort of like American Utopia. It's just sort of this like hybrid concert theatrical event that kind of defies categorization. Loved it. Darren Brown's Secret.
Love a magic show.
Love a magic show. And this
Robin
is like
is magic.
Magic of the highest degree. It's really like illusion. It's like subconscious manipulation. He like hypnotizes the audience. I was somewhat hypnotized during it. I don't want to give anything away, but like, you got to go see Darren Brown, Secret. Loved it.
I sort of feel like you're easy to hypnotize. I feel like, you know, some people are susceptible to that sort of thing.
No, I think that's true.
I feel like you're an easy mark.
Yeah. I just love magic of any form, from like the cheapest, you know, woman in a box with swords trick to like you know, the most high scale Darren Brown level.
It's nothing to be ashamed
stuff.
Of, Rob.
I'm not ashamed.
Right. I just want to make sure.
Do You Feel Anger, which was a play that was at the Vineyard that I loved.
Yeah, you did love that play.
Oh my God. And again, that was one that kind of overlooked.
Yep.
Heroes of the Fourth Turning at Playwrights, which was widely celebrated. Really terrific play. Into the Woods, which we saw at Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival over the summer.
That was magic.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we saw like five Into the Woods this year, but this was the one that really stuck with me.
Well, this was, yes, and for me, it was two things. It was one, the terrific, creative, inventive production.
Yes.
But it was also the discovery of the Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival, which is truly a gem.
Yeah.
And
put it on your calendar for next summer.
Both of those things combined really made for a magical two nights in the theater.
Totally. There was a really terrific production of Julius Caesar at Theater for a New Audience in Brooklyn that I adored. Little Shop of Horrors, which is currently off Broadway.
And just extended
with
Gideon Glick, who will come back in January and run it for a little while.
So it opened with Jonathan Groff, who we saw, and then Gideon stepped in for a week while Jonathan Groff did press for Frozen 2. And then Jonathan Groff came back and is currently in it. And now Gideon's going to take it through, I think March is what they've announced, and hopefully it runs longer.
I have a feeling it's going to run a while. I think they've got gold with this
production.
This
is the little shop that you have always wanted to see.
100%. Right? Yes. Yeah. Yes. This
totally captures the essence of what the show is, and it's a top-notch production. They didn't spare any cost.
No, not at all. And when we can, I think we're going to probably talk about this in the new
year. Its own show. Yeah.
But I will say there's lots of possibilities with this show in terms of casting and people that can come in and do various roles.
Yes.
It could run a very long time.
It could run forever.
Yeah.
The original production ran like 8 years.
It certainly
off Broadway.
Did. Yeah.
I mean, it was a sensation.
I feel like this is as close to that production as we're ever going to get.
Totally. Ooh, I love
that. And it's its own thing. And it's its own beautiful,
right.
Wonderful.
It's not trying to be a recreation.
Not at all. Right. It lives in its own beautiful world.
Totally. The Michaels, the Richard Nelson play that was at the Public Theater.
I smell baked bread right now.
Yeah, seriously. One of the most intimate and beautiful things I've ever seen. I mean, it was absolutely terrific.
I have to thank you for that, because I wasn't going to go see that. No, and you were the one that nudged me into going. And that might have, nobody wants my top 10 list, but that might actually have made the list if I were writing it.
Totally. Much Ado About Nothing, Shakespeare in the Park.
Oh yeah.
Danielle Brooks. That's all I have to say. Kenny Leon directed. Oh my God. It was one of the best Shakespeare in the Parks ever.
And that was also filmed. So you can see that.
Yes,
you can see that as well. It was on PBS 2 weeks ago.
Really terrific. Teresa Rebeck's Seared at MCC Theater.
Warranted an entire show.
Yes, go listen to it. Really terrific. The Sound Inside, you know, was a really close runner-up to be in my top 10.
Yeah.
Mary Louise Parker and Adam Rapp's play. Absolutely brilliant. David Cromer directed,
I've been threatening this for days. I think I'm going to go back.
You should go back. Yeah. Everyone should see The Sound Inside. Yeah. It's one of the best plays I've seen in my life. And then The Wrong Man at MCC Theater. Again, this is four MCC Theater shows on this list this year.
MCC is continually doing some
of
the best
right now.
Best stuff. And I will say, Joshua Henry singing Stay Positive from The Wrong Man will remain a theatrical highlight of my life.
100%.
That is one of the most thrilling performances of I've ever seen.
Oh yeah.
That man is
I'll see him in anything. I'll watch him read the phone book, but like
that was that defining. Was
absolutely stunning. Great.
There it is.
All right. Wow. Well, that's 2019. We did it.
The year is over.
The year is over.
I can't believe it.
I know. Wild.
It's been a good year.
It's been a good year. Yeah. It's been a very good year. And much to look forward to in 2020.
I can't wait.
A new decade.
A new decade.
Wow. A new world.
Well, I think that's it for us for today.
That's it. Yeah. Yeah.
We've got another couple of episodes before the year is out.
That's right.
And then we're going to take a little break for Christmas.
Top 10s are coming out earlier and earlier every year.
Well, that's why we moved ours. Our top 10 was on New Year's.
Like the 26th. It was on Boxing Day, right?
Was it on Boxing Day? I thought it was on New Year's Day. But
well, it was towards the end of the year.
Whatever it was. Yeah, I'm sure you're right.
The true end of the year.
You're smarter about these things. But well, that's it. I don't have anything else to say.
Alrighty. Well, here's to great theater.
Okay. That's our show. Thanks for listening. You can hear us anytime on iTunes. And if you like what you hear, rate and review us. The Fabulous Invalid is a production of O&M Etc., The Fabulous Invalid LLC, and a proud member of the Broadway Podcast Network. Our theme music is by Lucky Chops. Today's episode was edited and engineered by Aaron Kaufman and Charles Van Kirk. You can find us online at thefabulousinvalid.com and on social media at Fabulous Invalid. And be sure to tune in next Wednesday.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.